Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz today.
You have the question of whether or not Fani Willis, the district attorney in Fulton County, was engaged in impropriety. We learned about her lover, Nathan Wade, who's the prosecutor, the special prosecutor, who she was having a sexual relationship with. He was taking her on vacations, and she allegedly reimbursed him in cash. No, I don't believe that's what happened. Tony Katz today, good to be with you. But the question was, is Fani Willis able to carry on this case against President Trump, utilizing RICO, going after him for trying to fix an election in 2020? And the judge in the case, Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee, says, well, if I close my left eye and squint a little bit, maybe. William Jacobson joins us right now, Cornell law professor, the mind behind legalinsurrection.com. Walk me through what it is that the judge in this case, Scott McAfee, said, and how you translate that ruling.
Well, it was quite a ruling. You mentioned split the baby. That is one way I've heard it described. I think it's probably a little worse than that, because he found really impropriety went on, and it went on between two prosecutors, and he's leaving one of them in place. Okay, and he's letting them pick which one will remain in place. So it's a very odd result. I think he was very cautious in, you know, his decision, other than the result, which is strange, and applied what he believed to be the standards of conduct. He did not find an actual conflict of interest. I'm with you. I'm not buying that she paid for her trips in cash. Okay, I'm not buying that for a second. But he said there was no direct proof otherwise. So I think he was very cautious. I think he recognized that one or more of them lied on the stand, because there was a reference in there that this may be something to be considered by others, like disciplinary board in Georgia and the Bar Association in Georgia, but it's not really relevant to his determining this motion. So he was very cautious, really tried to stay in what he viewed as his lane legally. But the result is kind of absurd. I mean, the result is very strange. You found strong evidence of an appearance of impropriety here, and you're leaving one of the two people who created that appearance of impropriety in the case. Why? They should both go. So that's he was very cautious, very careful, but at the end came up with a result that I don't think makes a lot of sense.
And so there's this idea that when you try to make everybody happy, you don't make anybody happy. And that would lead one to think that this was a political decision, not a legal decision. Walk me through a legal part of this, which is, if there is a lawyer in a case engaged in whatever the level of impropriety, regardless of the surrounding circumstances of the impropriety, what is there a usual standard that is applied?
Well, this is a little different, first of all, than the usual case. This is a prosecutor, and a prosecutor has a higher duty. You know, everybody's got to tell the truth, and everybody's got to comply with the ethics rules, but a prosecutor really has a duty to the public that an attorney representing a private individual doesn't. And so that's, I think, makes his decision worse, not better. And, you know, so in the prosecutorial context, and he did go through this, that they have to be in Georgia, it's a mandatory disqualification only if you find an actual conflict of interest. And he found not an actual conflict of interest. He found that it had not been sufficiently proven that she financially benefited from the arrangement. Of course, anybody watching that and hearing it knows, of course, she financially benefited. But the judge found it wasn't proven in court. And so that's the standard. He said, so he can't kick her off because there's no other allegations here other than, you know, conflict of interest. There's no claim she should be kicked off for testifying falsely. That could be the next motion, but that's not before him right now. And so the only standard in Georgia is an actual conflict of interest. He said there is another possibility which is not really clear in Georgia, but he believed does exist in the court's inherent power, which was the perception, public perception of impropriety and the appearance of impropriety. And he thinks that is sufficient, but that does not require disqualification. And it was his judgment that given all of the evidence that came in, given that there was no direct conflict of interest, that the appearance of impropriety would be relieved for the court's purposes if one of the two left the case. I don't agree with that. I think once you found it, they both need to go. But that was his reasoning.
So let's take a moment to dig into that. Talking to William Jacobson, Cornell Law Professor, LegalInsurrection.com. Hey, you guys did something that wasn't right. So you decide which one of you is punished. That doesn't sound like, and for a lot of people, they're shaking their head in agreement with you, sir. That doesn't sound like judge talk. I know you guys did something that wasn't okay. You figure out who's to blame, and then we can move on. Isn't the entirety of the case? Couldn't the Trump team now say, whoa, this isn't enough? Do they then appeal it forward? What is their process from here?
Yeah, well, I think you're right, and that's a piece I think I left out. What makes it even more bizarre is he's letting them decide which one goes, okay? So it's like you arrest two people for a crime they both committed, and you let them decide which one of them will be prosecuted. So that's going to put her in an interesting decision. Is she going to cut off the cash flow to her, you know, her lover, or is she going to remove herself? If she removes herself, then the case goes to a different district attorney's office. He's just a special assistant district attorney. So it's just an entirely bizarre procedure to not say they both go and then to leave it up to them which one of them goes. That's just very strange. In terms of process, I'm going to assume this is some sort of appealable order. I don't know that. I haven't looked into that in Georgia. Even if it's not absolutely appealable, they could also always request leave to appeal, because why would you want to go on with this whole case only to have whatever the verdict is thrown out because the prosecutors were conflicted? So I would think an appeals court would want to hear it. Whether it's required to hear it, I don't know, under Georgia law, but that's their process. Yes, I would expect Trump's team, or actually this motion was not brought by Trump, it was brought by a co-defendant. I would expect their team to try to appeal this and try to say, you know, the judge was wrong, and the remedy here, based on the judge's findings of an appearance of impropriety, that based on his findings, the remedy needed to be get these prosecutors off the case, not let the prosecutors decide which one of them leaves. So I think that we may likely see even more delay here if the appeals court is willing to hear this case. And I think they should. I don't think we should go through a trial in a high profile case like this involving a former president and presidential likely nominee in the middle of a general election when the whole process may be tainted. I think an appeals court needs to look at that.
Now, something else happened in this case, which involves a speech that Fannie Willis gave on Martin Luther King Day, which is referred to by Trump's legal team, the lawyer being Steve Sadow, S-A-D-O-W, as extrajudicial. Here, let me play this for you.
I hired one white man, brilliant, my friend, and a great boy. And I hired one black man, another superstar, a great friend, and a great lawyer. First thing they say, oh, she gonna play the race card now.
All right.
Now, that was a speech that she gave at a church. And that speech, it has been argued, including by people on CNN and other places, that this is out of control. This was unbelievably inappropriate for her to do. This puts her in a place of real questioning of whether or not she has tainted a jury pool by having this extrajudicial conversation. Talk to me about the constraints when one is dealing with a case, and should the judge, in your view, have put more weight on these comments?
Well, as I recall from the decision, the judge found those comments to be improper, but not something to be considered on this motion. I think he said it could be considered later on something, if I'm remembering correctly, from the decision. So I don't think that's done. There could be a motion made to dismiss the case for improper jury tampering, essentially, improper publicity. But on the motion to disqualify, he found he didn't need to make that decision, but he almost invited them, which would be all the defendants, but he invited them to make a motion. I mean, he didn't literally invite them, but from his suggestion was that this really would be something we would consider on a motion addressed to improper pretrial publicity, that's when he would consider it, but he didn't need to consider it on this matter before him.
And that's a whole nother part of this, that people are going to focus on what the judge has said regarding splitting the baby. All right, Fonnie Willis, you either go or your lover goes, right? It's one or the other. What you're discussing is this part two, that there are now other places where Trump or one of the 18 co-defendants, because this is a RICO case, a racketeering case, they're bringing in all these people, providing all these charges to try and squeeze people to get at Trump, where they could say, wait a second, this lawyer, this prosecutor, this DA, I should say, has been inappropriate. There's a problem. I can't get a fair trial. This whole thing has to be thrown out, or at least has to move jurisdictions, and we have to delay. That part of it is what you're saying most probably will be coming in the days ahead.
I would think so. And that would potentially taint the entire trial. It wouldn't just taint whether Fannie Willis can stay on the case. So that would be actually a much bigger motion, probably resulting in a change of venue, that they may have to move this to another part of Georgia if the Atlanta pool has been tainted by improper pretrial publicity by the prosecutor. So Trump may get a more favorable location in Georgia. I don't think they'd have to move it out of the state, but if he, you know, so I think that might be coming. I would expect it would be coming in one form or another.
Before I let you go, talking to William Jacobson, Cornell Law Professor, legalinsurrection.com, I wanted to ask you about Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, and his commentary about having elections. Israel should have elections and get rid of Netanyahu. Netanyahu is the problem. You have been certainly outspoken about being Jewish, about support for Israel. You're on lists of people who are influencers in this space. You have dealt with threats because of it. Your take on Chuck Schumer calling for a new election in the middle of a war and getting engaged in Israeli politics?
Yeah, so you're only going to leave me a minute or two to completely rant on Chuck Schumer. Have me back for a 30-minute segment, please. It's disgusting what he did. Okay, it's pandering. It's pandering to the anti-Israel Democratic base, the pro-Hamas vote in Michigan. It is the worst thing he could possibly have done, because he's trying to divide the Jewish community. He knows there's in the American Jewish community, which is overwhelmingly liberal, he knows there's, you know, some dislike for Netanyahu. And what he's trying to do, he's trying to separate Israel and Netanyahu, which has been Biden administration policy. I wrote about this about 2 weeks ago. That's where they're going, to distinguish. Well, we hate Netanyahu, but we love Israel. Well, they're in the middle of a war, okay? And why do they hate Netanyahu so much right now? It's because he's refusing to capitulate to the American president and the American Secretary of State, who want Hamas to survive. They do. You can't read their actions any other way. Hamas now exists only in Rafah, 4 battalions by all counts, which is thousands of Hamas fighters. That's where the leadership is. That's where the hostages is. And all of American policy for the last 2 to 3 weeks, maybe months, has been to try to bully Israel into not finishing off Hamas. And now Chuck Schumer steps in and picks up that cudgel and he hits Netanyahu over the head. And why is he hitting Netanyahu over the head? It's because he's been too uncompromising. You know, I think there's going to be a huge backlash to this. I think what Schumer did is disgraceful. He's trying to walk it back. Too late, Chuck. You will not walk it back. Your legacy will be that you betrayed not just the Jewish people, but you betrayed Western civilization and your own country with these comments at a critical moment in history. Because let's face it, the people Israel is fighting in Gaza and elsewhere are enemies of the United States. They are enemies of Western civilization. What they did on October 7th, they would do to us in a heartbeat if they could. And Chuck Schumer is fighting to prevent them from being destroyed. It's disgraceful. He will never live this down.
Next time I give you the full 30 minutes. That's all there is to it. That is William Jacobson, Cornell Law Professor, LegalInsurrection.com. Always appreciate you, sir. More is coming up. I'm Tony Katz. Supreme Court making a decision. I should have asked William Jacobson about this. I should have done it. The Supreme Court outlines when officials can be sued for social media use. Wait, what? Tony Katz. Tony Katz today, what's going on? The ruling is that members of the public, in some circumstances, can sue public officials for blocking them on social media platforms. So the court ruled unanimously that officials can be deemed state actors when making use of social media and can therefore face litigation for blocking or muting a member of the public. The ruling by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, the court acknowledged that, quote, it can be difficult to tell whether the speech is official or private because of how social media accounts are used. But that conduct on social media can be viewed as a state action when the official in question, quote, possessed actual authority to speak on the state's behalf and, quote, purported to exercise that authority. So a lot of this had to do with Trump in the days that he was president. I think this is very interesting. If I'm a member of Congress and somebody every day is writing on my social media feed, filling it up with, you're a Nazi, I can't block that person. I'm not allowed to push that out. The argument is what? That somehow an action was taken by that governmental official to silence me, to prevent my free speech. Huh. The court's clear that conditions have to be met for a claim to move forward, noting, as Amy Coney Barrett did, that government officials are also, quote, private citizens with their own constitutional rights. So this is a conversation of the official congressional Twitter X account versus the personal X account or Facebook account or whatever the case may be. I swear, I can't wait to see how this gets applied. And what would, am I suing that you're taking away my right if you block me? Now, I don't have to answer. No one is suggesting that answers have to be given. What is being argued is that you can't stop them from basically asking the question. That's very, very interesting. I will say, I really do feel for a lot of these elected officials because their mentions are about to get destroyed. If people are like, wait, they can't block me? If they do, I could sue? Excuse me, I have to type a lot. And then they're screaming upstairs, Ma, more meatloaf! And then that's a Will Ferrell homage. And then they're just going to go to town. Oh, I got to assume the next couple of months for these guys. Gonna be brutal. One more reason not to run for office. One more thing to keep the good people out of an elected position. Find everything at TonyKatz.com. This is Tony Katz Today. science is absolutely amazing. It is incredible the levels of progress that we're making in a series of fields. Did you see SpaceX yesterday? Did you see what's going on there? The massive step forward in being able to not only engage space flight, but how it's done and the ability to recycle and reutilize parts and boosters. SpaceX launched a rocket that was 400 feet tall. Now, it flew for an hour. It got lost re-entering Earth's atmosphere. Guys, sometimes bad things happen. Do you have any idea what it took to get air flight as safe as it is today? The amount of people who died, the amount of damage and damage that was done and risk that was involved? The mission, as everyone describes it, got much farther than the two Starship test flights prior. And it is all in a concert with getting people not only to the moon, but getting people to Mars. It's incredible what's going on. Equally as incredible, clinical trial results showing rapid and dramatic regression of glioblastoma. We're talking about brain cancer, people. I have done in my history a lot of work with The Cure Starts Now, which deals with something called DIPG, diffuse intrinsic pontine gliomas. It affects children. It is so awful. It is so absolutely awful. It is this, it's kind of a dusting of cancer around the brainstem. And it's inoperable. And it kills. That's what it does. And they work on it, and they raise money for it, and I appreciate the efforts, and they keep at it. And these families that lost their children keep at it. Nothing yet, but that's today. Who knows what tomorrow brings? This, from the New England Journal of Medicine, phase one clinical trials evaluating approaches for glioblastomas. Just days, as it's reported from medicalexpress.com, after a single treatment, patients experienced dramatic reductions in tumors, one achieving near complete tumor regression. Now, in time, what the researchers saw was tumor progression in these patients, but you take a look at some of the first results, you're like, wait a second, we've got an opportunity here. This is based on something called the CAR-T platform. I don't claim to be an expert in brain cancers. I'm not an oncologist, people. I'm just, we live in the world of negatives. We live in the world of constant bad news. There are good things happening, and there are smart people making it happen. One of the things these two stories bring up is that there is such a thing as expertise in the world. There are smart people in the world. We should recognize that. Not everybody can do everything. Look, I'm a pretty dang good radio host and entertainer. I am. I don't know if I would be a pretty good brain surgeon. My father has a theory that he has had since I'm a kid. Basically, it goes like this. I could be a brain surgeon if they just gave me three brains to practice on. It's his way of saying that he believes he can do anything. He believes he can learn something. Just give him the time to learn it. He could be great at the thing. And I think he used it as to an extent as an idea for inspiration. I always kind of took it that way. What I realized is, you know what? You can have the three brains, but it doesn't mean you're going to be a brain surgeon. Some people can and some people can't. And one of the reasons why I am not a progressive, I'm not a socialist, is that I accept this reality. Part of being a conservative, part of being a capitalist, is the recognition that some people can and some people can't. But that's subject to subject. Because I can on one subject doesn't mean I can on another subject. But conservatism and capitalism allows me to then move towards the areas where I have a natural predilection and I have a better chance for success, both on a personal level and on an economic level. That makes sense to me. That is a rational position. I'm glad there are people out there engaged in this level of study. I am thrilled that they're having such incredible success. This is good. Not good is a study that was done by the Harris poll. This was in association with Axios. And here's how it starts. More than two-thirds of college students believe universities should protect free speech. Oh, well, wow. Look at that. That's different. I didn't think these college students were in favor of free speech at all. I didn't think they gave a good holy damn about free speech. Look at this. All of a sudden, they care about free speech. That is excellent, excellent news. I didn't finish. More than two-thirds of college students believe universities should protect free speech, even if the speech extends to physical threats or inciting violence. Oh, well, that's different, because we as a liberty society would never consider physical threats or incitement as free speech. And if it is now free speech, I guess that means all the college students all across America are totally fine with Donald Trump inciting a riot on January 6th. No, that's not me saying. They say he did that. I never said he did it because I don't think he incited anything, although I do think it was a riot and not an insurrection. But now we're talking about actually being okay with physical threats and inciting violence. So clearly the college kids would be okay with what their progressive overlords are telling them happened on January 6th. That is remarkable. How in the world does this come out? Here's what Axios says. AXIOS, Axios.com. The stunning finding reveals a desire to push the limits of free expression on campus. It hints at deep divides over how to advocate for Palestinian civilians while protecting the safety of Jewish students. Oh. So to shut up the Hebes, am I not allowed to say that? I'm Jewish. I think it's okay. I'm just describing it as the Jew-hating bigots on college campuses would describe it. You know what? I'll clean it up. I'll clean it up because I don't want an issue. I don't want an issue. To shut them Jews up. There, is that better? That's somehow better. My gosh. So to shut them Jews up on college campuses, you could threaten violence to support a terrorist organization, Hamas, and the destruction and the elimination and the full-on genocide of the Jews you just decided to threaten. Holy crap! I would just like to remind people of something. If I could, it seemed like it would be the right time to remind people of this. Whether you're Jewish or not, this sounded like a good idea. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. I don't know. Just thought that needed to be said. 68% of students argued for pushing the limits of free speech on campus, even if there's some risk of violence. 77% of respondents said campus speech should be protected, even if some feel the language is deeply upsetting. 86% said their institutions should make them feel safe, sharing their opinions on tense social issues and global conflicts, and be a safe haven for free speech for the student body. Now, I'll tell you that some of those numbers, I'm only sad where they're at. 77% of respondents said campus speech should be protected, even if some feel the language is deeply upsetting. Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. I could not agree more with this idea. I could not agree more with this concept. But you think it's okay to physically threaten people? Hey, Jews, be quiet or we're going to beat you. This is, hey, Jews, hide your Jewishness or else. Don't be wearing those yarmulkes. Don't be putting nothing on your head except a baseball cap. That's all you get. We're really pushing the violence. 55% of students said their school's administration is more concerned with protecting endowments and donors than protecting expression. That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. 57% of students said their university had a bias toward Israel or pro-Israel issues as opposed to favoring Palestinians. Is that right? Because I take a look at the college campus, and it's very clear where the professors and where a lot of the students are, at least those vocal ones, engaging in the threats. Crazy stuff. Again, I remind you, college students, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It's a good reminder. Free speech, that means threats. That's a broken society, right? Like we're broken at that moment. Free speech does not exist for the speech that you like. It exists for the speech and the people that you hate, that you despise, that make you sick. Because chances are the person who makes you sick is sickened by you. And you would never let them take away your right to speak. Why would you take away theirs? This is the authoritarianism. Which brings us to Canada. Oh, Canada. There is a law called the Online Harms Act. This legislation would allow judges to imprison adults for life if they advocate for genocide. Now, let's take a moment. When in Germany, they have legislation, laws that say that one cannot engage in Holocaust denial. I'm not a German citizen, so I would comment from the outside. I guess I could understand why that legislation came about when it did. The Holocaust being pure evil, perpetrated by German citizens. They do not want to forget, and they will not accept a whitewashing of history. I guess I could see that. One of the things I've never understood is why I would hate or be angry with or hold guilty a German citizen of today for something that was done 80 years ago. I didn't say forget. I'm not engaging forgetting. I don't hold a German 12-year-old responsible for what happened in 1938 or in 1941 or in 1944. I don't. And I think it's kind of a maddening proposition to do such a thing. That they would have legislation that says you do not get to deny the Holocaust is a very personal thing, very cultural thing, and whether I agree with it or not, I think it's going to remain. But the idea that we imprison people for saying terrible things, no. No, I don't want to do that. Now, advocating for genocide, like if someone said, get rid of all the, you could argue that that is an act of violence, or I should say a call to violence, I should say. But I don't know if I want to imprison those people for life because of it. I seem to tend to being a free speech dude. But the law would also allow a provincial judge to impose house arrest and a fine if there, and this is how it's reported, if there were reasonable grounds to believe a defendant will commit an offense. This is Minority Report. You mean you think somebody is going to say something? So you take away their rights before they do anything? That's insane. Well, it's just as insane as in saying, yeah, I believe in free speech, and you should be able to threaten people you don't like as well. That should be covered. That should not be covered. Throwing people or fining people and putting them under house arrest, therefore imprisoning them for something they might say? That's tyrannical. This is, by the way, Justin Trudeau's Canada, because the apple does not fall far from the Fidel Castro tree. Justin Trudeau is Fidel Castro's son. Are we pretending? Go take a look at the side-by-side photos. Get back to me. As a society, we have drifted away across the globe from free speech. And we're starting to see the cracks in American society that will not bring us any good. Endangers us all. We need some of those experts curing cancer and sending us to Mars working on these speech issues pronto. I'm Tony Katz. I hope by now you've had a chance to see the videos that I created when I was in Israel, and I still have more videos to get edited and get up. Tony Katz today, what's going on? There, if you go to Rumble and just search for Tony Katz, they are there. If you go to Instagram, Tony Katz, be sure to like, subscribe, and all the places. You'll see them there as well. The objective is simple. Share them. Share them everywhere. Let people see what happened. Let them let you bear witness to what took place, what actually occurred at the hands of Hamas terrorists. I'm asking for the help. I'm asking you to share them. I'm asking you to like them. I'm asking you to help me get them out there. The conversations about the farms, the conversations with the doctors, the conversations with the teachers, the actual showing of the horror that took place in these homes, the destruction, the death. Can't hide. This is happening. It's important to see. So I only hope you'll help me out and share them everywhere you can. Find them on Rumble, search for Tony Katz, or Instagram Tony Katz. And find everything, of course, at TonyKatz.com, including the videos. Monday, everyone. Take care.